evening, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world on KBC.com. I am Alan Gervey, the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervey & Wynn. And today, as usual, I'm here. Well, I'm not there. I'm here at my home to be the managing partner of your life, and I probably can't manage anything while I'm at my home. So I have Lauren Savant in studio. She can manage everyone's lives and manage this show very well because I can't seem to do that when I'm not around Lauren. Lauren?
Well, now that you've given away your secret and told everyone that you're not actually in studio, I guess we can give up this charade.
I was supposed to be, but something came up. And also, I must say that we are now 0 for 2. It's the last 2 weeks. We have had cancel on
there
us.
There we go.
The last minute. Here we go.
I feel a rant coming on.
The rant. Well, I can't do a complete rant because I have to be in studio to do that. I have two kids who are 7 and 8 years old, and they don't want to be hearing me saying these kind of words and listening
well,
to their dad.
Thank goodness for that.
Obnoxious. So I'm going to try and stay calm about it. But, you know, I'm a big baseball guy. In fact, tonight I had to coach some baseball, my son. And there's a game called 0-2 that we play, and what happens is all the kids go up to bat, and they're 0-2, meaning two strikes, and they get one pitch. If they miss it, that's strike three, they're out, and if they hit it, they stay in the game, and then we wait and see who is the last person standing. My daughter's team plays the same game, but they call it last girl standing, not 0-2. We are 0-2, two strikes. Fran Drescher last week canceled, and this week it was Larry Elder. And by the way, I just heard someone text me and said that Larry Elder was on the Mark Levin show tonight. Don't understand that.
That stings.
How did he give up on
that
us
stings.
And go on Mark Levin? And I was texting with Larry this weekend. He said, oh, yeah, I'm going to come on the show. So he better come on the show, whether he's governor or not. He better come on the show because we need to find out what he has in mind for the state of California, if he's governor, and if he's not, why he lost to Gavin Newsom.
There you go. We have a lot to ask him.
A lot. But you know what?
You know, all is not lost, Alan.
Absolutely. I was just about to say that. You and I think alike.
We do.
Genevieve Wong, who produces the show, always manages to get a better guest when one of our guests canceled.
It's true.
Wouldn't you agree with that?
Not only a better guest, she got two this time.
Two better guests.
Yeah.
So we're 2 for 2. We're not 0-2. And, you know, really screw the people who cancel on us because the people we get instead are way better.
Absolutely.
You know, they have something to say.
I'm really excited to speak to our guests, actually. They're both fascinating in their own right. Do you want to go ahead and introduce them?
No, you know what? You get so excited, and when you get excited, I do not want to stand in your way. So I want you to introduce them, and if I have anything to say, I'll just come in with a few witty comments, but go for it.
It's your show at the end of the day, Alan. I just want to make that clear.
At the end of the day?
Yeah.
Yes, but, you know, I know you have a passion. You are a news reporter, or have been, and you are so much more adept at documentaries. To have one of the best documentary filmmakers on our show.
Absolutely.
In the country, who
one
has
of the best.
Been so successful, two Academy Awards for Harlan County USA and American Dream, and a number of other fascinating documentaries. You know, that's something that you should really introduce. And when we talk about the political situation, you've had so much experience, much more than me, with political situations in other countries as a reporter. And, you know, when we talk about the Iranian hostage crisis and the youngest member of the hostages, Kevin Hermaning, as an Iranian hostage, you should be doing the introduction, not me.
Well, I think you've just done it. So let's get to our guests without further ado. Just in a, you know, Academy Award winning documentarian, Barbara Koppel is joining us on the line. Are you there, Barbara?
Oh, yes, I am.
So great to have you. Also joining us on the line is Kevin Hermaning, who, as you mentioned, Alan, was a hostage in Iran near 40 years ago now. So, Barbara, tell us about this new documentary that premieres this month.
Okay.
September 12th.
This began with the History Channel, and they wanted to do some documentaries about history that people really didn't know about. And one of the ones on their list was Desert One. And we sort of researched it a little bit and thought, this is something that we really want to do. And it takes place during the taking of 52 hostages by the Iranians, and they're held for a very long time, and Kevin can tell you so many stories about that. And also, too, Carter loses to Reagan, and a mission to free the hostages that doesn't work.
And why was this not known about? Why do you think we didn't know about this?
I think that people just didn't want to talk about it. I think that probably the people that went on the mission were angry and humiliated that, you know, Murphy's Law took over and things happened that they just couldn't explain and nothing worked.
You know, I want to ask you, Barbara, about Desert One because it has been reviewed very well. There's so many great reviews. I think Rotten Tomatoes had it at like 90%, and so many really encouraging words about it being inspiring, which is interesting in and of itself. But tell us a little bit about the history of it. It premiered a couple of years ago in Toronto, and now the History Channel has picked it up, and it's coming out for its television debut on September 12th at 8 p.m. on the History Channel. What happened in the interim while you obviously made the film some years ago? You had Walter Mondale on interview, who since passed away, and so many other people.
Jimmy Carter.
Jimmy Carter.
Well, it was showing theatrically. It was streaming, and Greenwich Entertainment was showing it all over the country. So that was, that went on for quite a while. It took a little bit to get that up and running because we were in the middle of COVID, and they did a very, very successful job, and it showed at many film festivals, including the National Board of Review and also the National Archives, and it was wonderful. It was incredible. But this is really, too, what we're waiting for, to have it show on the History Channel, because that means all the guys that knew about this or knew people who were part of this, whether they were a hostage or they were Air Force One trying to free them, Delta, will be able to see it. And that was what we wanted. It was very important to us.
It sounds like an incredible piece of work that probably we should all watch. You know, right now we're watching what's going on in Afghanistan, and I can't help but make some connections to that. But we also have Kevin on the phone joining us here as well. And Kevin was one of the hostages that lived through this. In fact, the youngest. Kevin Hermaning joining us now. Are you on the line with us?
I am. Thank you for the invitation to join you. And good evening, Barbara.
Good evening to you, Kevin.
Thank you so much for joining us, Kevin. So from your point of view, you were 19 years old when this happened. I can only imagine it's probably etched in your mind forever, for the rest of your life.
Well, you know, can you really be called the youngest when something happened 40 years ago and you're now in your early 60s?
Still young.
You know, the reality is that so many times over the last 40 years, my colleagues and I have personally been referred to as heroes, when in fact, while we appreciate that, it's not true. We were survivors. We were victims of circumstances, much like a couple of weeks ago in Afghanistan when a distress message was sent by the embassy staff back to Washington, D.C. The State Department missed the call, and they didn't take our people out of Afghanistan, and they didn't remove and close the embassy in Tehran in 1979, and 51 of my colleagues and I were held the entirety of the 444 days in captivity. And there's so many stories I could tell you about heroic behind-the-scenes experiences from some of my colleagues, from Colonel Charles Scott to Bill Keel, one of only two civilians who were held there the whole time. But while we were survivors and victims of being in a bad circumstance at the time, there were more than eight heroes, but with certainty there were eight true heroes who gave all. Three Marines and five airmen who perished that night at Desert One during a tragedy mm-hmm. that was not foreseeable. And Barbara's team captured the messaging, captured the emotion for sure. And I had the true and extreme privilege of meeting so many of those men who survived that mission. And they're almost to a person, their wives told me 2 years ago, pre-COVID, at the world premiere up in Toronto of Desert One, that had they only known, meaning those men on the mission, had they only known that we, the hostages, when we learned that they had tried, despite failing at the ultimate mission to free us, that that event was what kept us going the last 8 months. So in that sense, it was a success.
Wow.
That they would have lived a different life for the prior 40 years.
Wow.
That is incredible.
That is really something. That's saying something that is really meaningful. We only have a minute and a half before we have to go to break, but I want to ask you, Kevin, take us back for a minute. When you first arrived in Iran, now, I know that you didn't have a whole lot of ideas of what it was going to be like. You probably didn't know much about Iran at all. You were from the Midwest, Wausau, Wisconsin. Is that where you're from originally?
Originally from Milwaukee, but yep, in the Midwest, near just north of Chicago.
Yeah, so what was it like when you were there in a foreign country so different and with all the events occurring? And I know that asks for a long answer, but if you can tell us in 30 or 40 seconds, that'd be great.
Well, I had previously been in Japan as a Marine, a young Marine, for 15 months. And so for me, and yet another opportunity to visit a foreign land with a different culture and language than the United States was a tremendous opportunity and experience. And honestly, I loved the first 2.5, almost 3 full months that I was there, leading up to the first couple of days prior to the takeover of the embassy, of course. But I loved the opportunity to get out into the countryside and to visit people and to learn about the culture and learn Farsi a little bit. Marine security guards in every country in which they are based around the world are required to take 3 hours of language training a week in the foreign country, and I was in class 5 days a week because I was going to make that my home for at least a year. Eventually, it was involuntarily, but that was going to be what I intended to do.
Wow. You know, we have to take a break, but when we come back, we want to talk to Barbara Koppel about the Delta Force team and how this aborted or unsuccessful attempt at securing the hostages took place, and how she was able to really uncover so many pieces of information that had never been seen before, unearthing sources that for the last 40 years no one knew about. So we're going to talk to Barbara and Kevin after the break. You're listening to Gurry's Law right here, Talk Radio 790 KABC. You know, it's interesting that just said that we're turning Murphy's Law upside down. Well, apparently we're not today, because when we're talking about Desert One, the documentary produced and directed by Barbara Koppel, which premieres on the History Channel Sunday, September 12th at 8 p.m., Murphy's Law pretty much applied. It wasn't turned upside down. Lauren, I know you've heard that little lead-in for a long time. This is something, this story is really something that was botched by the U.S. Rescue team, and not necessarily their fault, but I want to hear from you, Barbara. You interviewed President Carter, which I know was difficult to get the interview. What was his impressions looking back 40 years at what happened with the Delta Force team?
Well, I think that, you know, he was a kind of person that wanted to bring everybody home, and he didn't want to leave any of them, and he didn't want anybody killed, and he really went for diplomatic negotiation. And these men were all volunteers who went. And what I found was so admirable about the Desert One operation and the men who undertook it was just the selfless mission of rescue intended to save 52 people who were being held against their will. And they did it because they felt that it was right, and they wanted to bring their fellow Americans home. And that's what President Carter was all about, too. And when he heard about, you know, the death of these eight men, even to this day, he was telling me a story about that he never had felt such waves of sadness, even when his own father died, as when he felt for these men and their families. So he was a person who's emotional about it. It was the worst day of his life. We also found, and we're the only people to have it, were audio, satellite, phone conversations between President Carter and the people who were on the ground, because it was a totally secret mission, and there was silence, and so they would give him reports, and we got to put some of those in the film, and just the way he spoke, they would tell him all this bad news, and he would just go, why did you have to find such a busy highway? You know, this was only in the middle of nowhere in a desert on a one-way road. So, you know, Carter, to me, is such a humanitarian and still cares deeply about this. And we showed the film at the Carter Center as well.
You know, there's so many perspectives you have here because, of course, we have, you know, Kevin on the phone as well, who was a hostage at the time. But then you see what was taking place, you know, diplomatically, politically, militarily. How did you figure out how to condense that into a documentary? Because there's so much and so many different perspectives.
Well, the hardest part and the biggest challenge of doing that was the mission itself, because there was no footage of it, because it was a secret mission. And so we interviewed so many people to tell us exactly what their role was and exactly what they saw and they felt. And then we copied all of that with animation, and we looked up, you know, where the helicopters would be positioned, what exactly they would look like. We just wanted to do it to perfection. So when the guys looked at this, they would look at us and go, whoa, how did you get all of this?
Yeah.
This is very similar to how it happened.
That's really something. I want to ask you, Kevin, you mentioned that you went to the premiere at the Toronto Film Festival. Were you able to see some of the other hostages and some of the other folks that were involved in this whole affair at that time, and how has it impacted you and the others in terms of staying in touch or sharing an experience that none of us will ever hopefully have to endure?
So it wasn't in Toronto, but a couple of months later at the National Archives in Washington, D.C., the U.S. premiere, it was aired at the archives, and had an opportunity to meet with some of the other subjects in the film. And I would say that, as well as some of the family members, by the way, of those who were in captivity with me. And I would say that while a handful of us have stayed in touch over the last four decades, about half of us have already passed on. And there are some who just have, in their effort to put the experience behind them, have ended up keeping it bottled up inside of them, and it has gnawed and eaten at them for the last 40 years, much like so many of our Korean and Vietnam veterans who never really had the type of welcome home that they so much deserved. They didn't ask to go to war. They were volunteers in some cases, but eventually, they were all draftees, of course, in most cases, and not all, but most. And our country turned their back on them. We, on the other hand, got this massive welcome home in our hometowns, as well as at the White House and in New York City with the ticker tape parade. And we became symbols for the entire United States of America, all of our populace to rally around in 1981. Our release was the release for all of America from a dark chapter. Really, if you think about it, America's first real experience dealing with fundamentalism in the Middle East and terrorism that affected so many people. And it was on the nightly news. And for me personally, while I never ever wanted to become a professional hostage, I have a career, I have a job, I have a family. I am, yes, a former American hostage held captive for 444 days. I was the youngest of the 52, but I've moved on to many other chapters in my personal life. And part of it was because the Marine Corps, they put me on the road right after we got back from captivity to speak to high schools and civic groups and in church audiences. And that helped to act as a catharsis for me in getting whatever challenges that I might have had emotionally as a result of being in captivity out of my system. And that I really give a lot of credit not only to the service for helping me out, but our communities, my wife. I didn't know her at the time, but you know, it helps to have people who will keep you humble and who will make sure that you don't believe the headlines that sometimes are written about you, that type of thing.
Wow, that's really great. So that was, it turned out to be a great thing for you to heal from such a traumatic ordeal.
I also think the younger you are, though, the easier it is to bounce back from challenges such as this, whether, losing a parent at a young age. Not too young, but a young age, you can bounce back and move on with other parts of your life and surround yourself with people who you like and they love you. And that is such an important aspect as well. I just spoke in front of an audience a couple of evenings ago up near Minneapolis. All of my appearances are done gratis. I once in a while, a group will give me a couple of bucks for travel, but I turn around and donate it to the foundation that actually was set up to pay for college educations that came out of Desert One, the failure there, to pay for college educations for the orphaned children. Mm-hmm. And I told the audience what I'll tell your listeners. For me, getting up in front of an audience and sharing even a part of my experience after reminding the audience of the real heroes in the hostage crisis, those 8 fallen, I also thank them for having not forgotten about us during those 14 months, because that's an important aspect as well. And there have been a lot of TV specials done about this. There have been a couple of not very great attempts to cover the hostage ordeal and even in part the rescue mission and its challenges and its ultimate failure. But and I'm not just saying this because Barbara's on the phone and because I appeared in her film. This was the best overall, all-encompassing look at a very difficult chapter in relatively recent American history.
Right.
You know, I've seen a lot of people writing about the film that it should be required viewing for students so they understand a lot more about that time in history than they can be taught in the classroom. We have to take a break. Barbara and Kevin, can you stay on for a few more minutes after the break? I have a few more questions.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Thanks,
okay,
you guys.
Great. We appreciate that, because I do want to ask you, Barbara, about the filming in Iran and how that went and what it meant to you and how you were able to facilitate it. Also, we want to talk a little bit about the meaning of the film moving forward and how it can inspire others by reflecting back on what Kevin's talking about. So we're going to get to all that after the break. You're listening to Gurley's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. We're back. We are speaking to Barbara Koppel and Kevin Hermaning. The film is called Desert One. It premieres on the History Channel Sunday, September 12th at 8 p.m. It's the story of the failed U.S. rescue attempt at the American hostages being held at the American Embassy in Iran in 1980. Barbara produced and directed it and has a long list of successful documentaries that she has directed and produced. Barbara, I want to ask you, you had filming in Iran with an Iranian crew inside the country. How did that come about, and how difficult was that to facilitate?
Yeah, well, it was very, very important to us that we understood how the Iranians were feeling about this, from the hostage takers to translators to religious leaders and just to ordinary citizens, and how they perceived the rescue mission and how it impacted things in their country. And we couldn't get in ourselves. And we were able to find, we spoke to a lot of people on the phone, Iranian filmmakers, but we had the great privilege of getting to know two Iranian women who became the field producers over there. And they just shot the most incredible stuff. They really dug deep. There's this one story, and I think it's one of the most incredible pieces and interviews of our movie. It was about a man, you know, who was a young kid then. He was 11 when his bus was stopped as it passed through rural Iran, and it happened to be the same place where, you know, the mission, the people for the rescue mission were all loading up, and suddenly this bus came with all of these people in it, and it was one family that went on vacation every year to, you know, to boss one place to another. And this man told us the story of, you know, his fear and how he was feeling, but the most wonderful thing that he said was that when they, you know, when the Americans went away and the bus was released, that he was so happy because he couldn't wait to tell his friends all the story about this, his school friends, about this experience. And it's just like any kid, you know, 11 years old, something unbelievable happens to you and you tell it. And so it was that human element, you know, that was very connective. Also, one of the hostages, John Limbert, when he came home and they asked him about his experience, he just said that he really felt that the people of Iran were very talented. They were had a lot of kindness and a lot of ability, and he's hoping, you know, one day that he can go there. During his time there, he fell in love with Iranian women, and his children were born there, and he wants to be able to bring his grandchildren there, but so far he hasn't been able to. But that part of the film and section of the film was very, very important for us to be able to do, because you just can't have one perspective.
As we look back now on, you know, the war in Afghanistan that's gone on for 20 years, when we talk about failure of a military operation as, you know, what happened at Desert One, you also have to talk about failure of the intelligence community not to, to see, right, the revolution that was happening under under their noses that led to all of this, really. So there was more than one failure here as far as the U.S. government was concerned. I mean, that's to you or Kevin to discuss, because, I mean, I know as a student of history, I studied it in college, but But now we see, you know, all over again, the same lessons of history being played out again in Afghanistan. So what are your feelings on that now, 40 years later?
Kevin?
Well, Barbara, and really for all of your listeners this evening, I would say that it causes all of us to give pause to, I think, the motives of some people who have made a career of government, and I don't mean elective politics, mm-hmm. but people who in many cases have a vested interest in outcomes that don't necessarily impact themselves. I think coming back out of the break, there was a reference to, you know, a failure on the part of the mission itself, or maybe I misunderstood, but you know, it really came down to the failure of the mission was due to a couple of mechanical failures and some bad weather. There were some other details, I suppose, that are relevant and important, but ultimately it comes down to that, and neither of those were predictable or avoidable. Sure, they might have sent in an extra 8 or 10 helicopters, but to what point, mm-hmm. if you're attempting to keep things secret? And while in hindsight, of course, an extra 5 or 8 helicopters probably would have resulted in a successful mission, we don't really know. But when it comes to the failure on the intelligence front, I would simply say, especially in stark contrast to what has gone on in Afghanistan, I loved what somebody mentioned. I'm not exactly sure which one of you said it, that it should be required viewing in history class. Mm-hmm. I happen to be the school board president in the community where I reside, and I hadn't thought about that as a possibility in history class. But the truth is, these guys were so committed to the mission. They were so committed to rescuing people who they had never met personally, nor had they met our families, that when I had the opportunity to meet some of these fellows years later, most of whom I met only a year and a half, 2 years ago, but I met a few back in 2010 rather, on the 30th anniversary at a fundraising event in Washington, D.C. for the Special Ops Foundation. These guys came up to me and said, despite the tragedy, despite losing 8 of their fellow countrymen, their comrades, despite some injuries that many of them had for years, I met a fellow who was in the San Antonio Burn Center because of the explosion and the burns he had faced for 8 months after we got out, after the failed mission. And these guys said to me, the next time you see any of your fellow hostages, please let them know that despite the risk, despite the tragedy, despite the risk, if ever called upon to do something like that again, they would be the first ones in line.
Wow.
So, you know, Barbara tells the story of these men who were willing to give all to rescue people they hadn't ever met. And I think that
You know, Kevin, that's very interesting. It begs a question that I want to address with Barbara right now. You did so many interviews.
One quick little story, if I could,
sure.
Which is, I was just speaking with one of the hostages and telling him all, you know, that the film was going to be coming out and everything, and we started talking about Afghanistan a little bit. And he said, I'm trying with everything that I have to get out a 15-year-old and a 17-year-old who are so brilliant and are so helpful. And if I can get them out, they're going to come and live with me. And his name's Mike. And I said, Mike, I came to your house and I filmed you and you have antiques. We couldn't even touch anything. Everything is in its place, immaculate. And he just looked at me and he said, this is the most important thing to me. I think my life should get very messy. So
Interesting. You know, we only have a minute or two left with you, and we could talk about this for hours. Real quickly, Barbara, I'm just curious. You've done so much research. You've talked to so many people. We've just had this Afghanistan situation occur. Do Do you or were there people you spoke to who thought that maybe more aggressive action should be taken in these kind of situations versus what happened in Iran and in Afghanistan?
Not to the people that I spoke to. I mean, Kevin's more active in the people today, but no, never. I mean, they talked about what they did. They talked about the cost of that, you know, to their families leaving and the fear that they wouldn't be coming back, even though they weren't allowed to say where they were going. But nobody ever said that to me, ever.
Okay. Well, I think, you know, it does raise interesting questions, but as you pointed out, which is a very important point, that, and I think Kevin said it as well, we don't know what the outcomes are. So, you know, it's easy to look back in hindsight, but tough at the time to make these decisions. And that's one of the beauties of this film that I think people need to see, because it really puts you in that place at that time by listening to people who were there and who had to make decisions and who experienced it. The film is called Desert One. It premieres on the History Channel Sunday, September 12th at 8 p.m. Kevin Hermaning, a hostage who obviously has made something great out of his life since then, and congratulations for that. And Barbara Koppel, the director and producer, who has had such a successful career in film. I want to thank you both for being with us today on Gervie's Law.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye.
All right. Thanks again. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back for the last few minutes of Gervie's Law right after this message. Wow, Wayman, you hit it on the head with that song. Don't You Forget About Me. I think it's so important that we think about history and we remember it and we learn from it. And Lauren, I know you are a history buff. I didn't know you were such a history buff, though.
What do you mean, such?
Well, you know everything. Every time we have a guest, you have, you know, you're like a Renaissance woman who has a little bit of information about a lot of things.
That's what I was going to say. When you're a reporter, you need to know a little bit about a lot. But, I mean, it's all, if you dig any deeper, it's all on the surface. But thank you, Alan. No, I am a student of history. I've always been fascinated by history, you know, and I studied Homeland Security after 9/11 because I was fascinated by that. So, I do, you know, I am very curious about how the U.S. has made their decisions, not just throughout my lifetime, but historically, because as we all know, history repeats itself. And so it's so important to learn, you know, from the past.
And you mentioned 9/11. We're coming up on a big anniversary coming up. So I think it's going to be an emotional time. I don't know if Genevieve has booked any guests to commemorate 9/11, but you know, through your reporting, because you're so passionate about it, have you ever really been kind of, I don't know, diverted in attention from the task at hand of reporting because you got so involved in a story?
You mean emotionally?
Absolutely. You are emotional.
Thanks, Alan. You know, I would like to believe that I mostly kept it together. I would definitely get off the air and break down sometimes when you're covering something awful or when there's children being harmed. It's really tough to not react emotionally. For me in particular, covering any kind of horrible things that happen to animals is my biggest weakness. I have a tough time with that. You know, I think all of us have a tendency to compartmentalize things, and we kind of just get the job done, and you're under a deadline, and you kind of do what you have to do. But on 9/11, I will tell you, I was in a control room that morning when we saw the planes hit, and we stayed in that control room for hours on end because we didn't take any breaks and we didn't leave the air. And I'll never forget, I turned around, and it was the first time in my news career that I saw the entire staff in the control room crying. Everybody had tears down their face because no one had seen anything like that.
Yeah, I can imagine. And you were young, very young at that time. So I think it's even more painful. You know, listening to Kevin Hermaning talk, who was an Iran hostage talk now, he sounds so mature, so put together. And he talked about how 40 years changes us.
Yeah.
And I think whether it's 40 years or 20 years, we look back on these situations and we're just not as impacted in that kind of way that we are when we are in our 20s or teens,
mm-hmm.
and something so traumatic occurs.
Yeah, and I'm sure that, you know, your children will look back on this pandemic and think, what a strange time it was to live through. You know, these things shape who you end up becoming.
Yeah, forget about the kids. What about us? I don't know how
and us, how
we're getting through it.
We're less resilient, you and I.
And well, it just keeps going on and on. And, you know, we get good news at one point and then bad news and good news and bad news. It's tough to really, you know, maintain that kind of positive outlook as days go by and things, you know, you read on the news and I don't know. I'm trying to hold it together, but I'll tell you that there are moments, which I'm sure a lot of us are experiencing, when we're alone or when we're with our loved ones, when we're just thinking, when can we get back to a life that is more normal than it is now?
Oh, yeah, exactly. That's all I keep thinking.
You know, we're going to try, and I don't know if I should say this or not, because it's probably the jinx that I should not
mention. I think that's what
happens.
I think you jinx us when we promote a guest for the following week.
So are we ready to be jinxed? Do you want to be jinxed, or should I just leave it and tell everyone to go to our Facebook page?
Yeah, I think we should make it a big surprise.
Okay, because it's a really great guest next week, and I don't want to say it because you're right. Maybe we'll jinx it, but it's a little bit of happiness when, you know, when we talk about who we will have on, if he doesn't cancel like the last 2 weeks, the guests have canceled. If we can get him to actually come on, he's a legend, and what he has offered this world is just so much inspiration and, I don't know, enjoyment. How would you describe it without saying what he does and what he's a legend at?
I mean, you've kept it really broad and vague, so how would I describe it? I would say iconic.
Yes.
And a piece of Americana, really.
Even though he's Canadian, I just gave a clue.
He?
He is Canadian.
Oh, I didn't know that.
You didn't know that. I believe he's from Ottawa. I'll check on that, but I know he's Canadian.
North American, then.
He is a piece of Americana, as Canadians say, Americana. but let's hope he doesn't cancel, because if he cancels, that's a hat trick. That's a hockey term from Canada. That'll be three in a row who cancel, and it's not going to make me happy at all, because these guests that Genevieve gets are amazing guests. They're great guests. They have a lot to say, and it's great to have these one-on-one conversations with them. But if they don't appear and they cancel, especially at the last minute, they will get trashed like they have never heard.
That's right.
And if anyone wants to, no mercy. If they want to hear about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and what I have to say about him, go to our website, GervysLaw.com. Check out all of our old podcasts, GervysLaw.com. And if you have a problem with what I said about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, please call me at my office. It's law firm of Rowan Gervy and Wynn, the law firm of Rowan Gervy and Wynn. I'm happy to talk to each and every one of you. And if you happen to have a workers' compensation claim, we can talk about that too. Lauren, it's been a pleasure. I will hopefully be seeing you in person next week.
I believe you will.
Well, and we have a great guest. Check out our Facebook, our Instagram, our Twitter. It's Gervy's Law. Go to our website, listen to some great podcasts, and thanks for joining us today. Have a great week.